Hey everyone, I'm Jeff Gibber, the president and chief strategist of True Voice Media. I'm also the host of Conversations, the True Voice Media podcast, where I bring on fascinating people from all walks of life and pick their brains about social media, entrepreneurialism, success, and so much more. For around the next 30 minutes, I get to have a really interesting conversation. You should stick around and listen in. So without further delay, let's get started.
This is episode 39. We're just about to hit 40, but for 39, I have an incredibly special guest with me today. I have Ian Altman. And Ian, normally what I like to do is turn it over to the guests that I have on to introduce themselves, but I would love the opportunity to introduce you and then give you the chance to fill in any gaps. Is that okay with you?
Absolutely, man. So you're going to introduce me. I have opportunity for rebuttal.
Yes, exactly. You can counter after I'm done.
That's awesome, man.
So for those that listen to this show, you know that the thing I love about it is that I get to have fascinating conversations with real people who are super duper interesting. And I just have to say that today is like a real treat to have you on. We met in this very exclusive Facebook group for speakers and authors and things like that. And although I'm not yet an author, I have the privilege of being in this group, and we got to meet and talk, and I looked into you, and it's crazy all the stuff that you're working on. So you're an author, multiple best time New York Times bestseller. You recently released Same Side Selling, which, if I'm not mistaken, Seth Godin said was one of the two books everyone should read on consultative selling, which, I mean, if Seth is saying that, that's ridiculous. Everybody knows.
Yeah, that certainly caught us by surprise when he said it. We had never met prior to then, and I will tell you the funny part was that it was in one of his blog posts. He said, hey, there's two books everyone should read on consultative selling, one old and one new. I saw the link to the one that was new. I wanted to see which book it was. So I clicked on it, and in Amazon, it opens up to Same Side Selling. And naturally, my thought was, oh, I must have had it cached in my browser. So let me shut down the browser and click on the link again and see what the book is. And then all of a sudden we realized, like, we're looking at the sales on Amazon, like, oh, that would explain it.
Yeah. I mean, I would go out for a fancy dinner if Seth Godin ever linked to anything that I did. So,
it was a very generous thing of him.
Yeah. So. But I mean, the thing is it's not just people like Seth Godin that are talking about this book. You're getting people like Daniel Pink and Chris Brogan who are saying a lot of great things about this book, and Daniel Pink, very well known for his work in sales. So obviously you've established yourself there as an author. You've also got your Grow My Revenue Business cast. You're a keynote speaker. You talk all over the world, and you're a part of Vistage and Cadre, so you're hanging with really the creme de la creme of people that are in speaking and that are authors. So what else, what have I missed? What else are you working on right now? Because so far that resume alone leads me to believe that getting you on this show is a major win for me. Tell me more.
Dude, it's not a major win. I'm flattered to be here. It's nice of you to give me any airtime here, and hopefully we'll add some value to the people listening. I guess the biggest thing we left out is that I've got a dog, two children, and a wife I don't deserve. And I write a column every week for Forbes, and in fact, my trends article just came out a couple days ago, and is it's always a good feeling when you click into BitLink to Bitly to create a BitLink, and it goes, wow, this thing is really hopping, and it's like measuring, you know, that you're getting 20 or 30 clicks a minute. On it that tells you that you may be onto something. So every year, as part of my weekly column in Forbes, I do one issue, which is the top trends we're seeing for the next year that are driving successful businesses, and that thing always gets a lot of attention. So it's fun to have those discussions too.
Well, for those that haven't read the Forbes article, and obviously everybody listening, we're going to put tons of stuff in the show notes for you to check out and follow Ian all over the web, and hopefully they'll come and check out your Forbes articles. But for those that haven't, what are some of the trends that you're going to see coming up in 2016?
Well, you know what, there's obviously 10 of them, and I don't want to go through them all because it's
less just some
about
highlights.
Me. I want to make sure we're getting some good stuff that's really actionable for your listeners. Some of the things that are really big, the first one, I talk about millennials, and I say that smart businesses will shift from complaining about to embracing millennials. And according to the Census Bureau, the largest group of individuals is people in their 20s. So it's like 80 million people. And I see people who are in the baby boomer generation sit there and say, well, these darn Gen Y, these darn millennials. It's like, dude, that's like the economy right now. Mm-hmm. So stop complaining about it. Start embracing it. And part of it gets down to recognizing that you've got people who want to do business differently than maybe other people did in the past. And every time someone gets cranky about that, I say, look, the guy before telephones, there was someone who, once telephones started to get popular, some guy came to the CEO of a company and said, hey, we got to start having customer support over the phone. And the guy said, well, that's stupid. If they want to talk to us, they can come in and speak to us. That's what everyone's always done. And guess what? They realized pretty soon that if they didn't do it, their competitors did, they'd be out of business. It's the same thing when someone says, well, I don't know why we have to respond to people on Snapchat. I mean, you know, we don't even, I don't use Snapchat. It doesn't matter. Do your customers use it? So that's one of the ones that that's gotten a lot of traction. Another one is the idea of the top businesses will focus on strengths-based more than remedial leadership. And what I mean by that is, instead of trying to fix where people are deficient, you try to skew their activities towards the areas that they're strong. So we're kind of saying, wherever you're good, let's magnify that and be that much better, instead of, hey, there are four things that you're doing in your job, and three of them you're great at, and one of them you suck at, so we're going to spend the next year focusing on the one you suck at. Well, it's not a good use of time. You're better off focusing on the other side, and there's a whole bunch of research from Gallup that supports that. That becomes a big deal. I'll touch on one more, and keep in mind there's 10 of them.
Yep.
So it's always tough for me to figure out where we go with this. But the one big one is that the best companies that don't want to be commoditized will focus on results with their customers. And this is something we talk a lot about in Same Side Selling. But the best companies that are getting top dollar for their products and services, what they're doing is they're actually having dialogues with their customers about how they generate the results that they need, rather than talking about how they make the sale. And what I mean by that is, if you think about the buyer-seller journey as a race, then if I ask most people in sales, what's the finish line? Most of them are going to say, well, the sale, the close, or the contract. But if I ask the customer says, well, the results. So if you're a customer and you got a choice of engaging two different services companies, and let's say it's, look, I want someone who's going to help us with social media. So they're coming to you, they say, Jeff, hey, listen, we're looking for help in our social media. We're trying to get more content out there. Hey, can you help us? And you talk to them about how you measure and ensure results, and the competition's asking them questions about who needs to sign off on this deal, they're going to be willing to spend a little bit more with you than they are with them, just because they see that you have a common vision or goal on results, as opposed to the other person just trying to make the sale. So those are three of the 10 that I just kind of arbitrarily grabbed through the article.
Yeah, I absolutely love all three of those. Can we dig a little bit deeper on some of them? Or I know you're very committed to this being actionable and everything. And there's just some things I want to play around with in there. And then I definitely want to get to some of your advice on sales, things that people get wrong, questions, answers, things like that. But this,
you know what, man? It's whatever you think is of most use to the listeners, I'm all in.
Yeah, I mean, generally, I just like to kind of – I had a woman on my show named Miley, and she was all about – curiosity and leadership. And the interesting thing is that I've always found that this podcast for me is about exploring curiosity. I mean, you have a very different background than I have, and you deal with clients in a different way, and you have things that you've read and been exposed to. And I just want to pick at that and try and learn from that. So really, I just let my curiosity take with me. So let's talk a little bit about millennials, because I'm fascinated by this, and I'm curious what your take is on it, and I want to dig a little deeper on it, because I'm what's known as a bridge generation. So the majority of my clients are older than me, and a lot of them are baby boomers, and then a lot of the people that I either work with or that are applying to my company are millennials. And I find that I'm in an ideal position to talk to both. I've grown up with a lot of the millennial technology. I operate very much like a millennial. I have similar values in what I value in my career as a millennial. But at the same time, I remember the early days before the internet was a thing that really was a force to be reckoned with. So from your perspective, what is this breakdown, and how is it resolved? Because it seems like there's just a miscommunication between the two. And usually I try and bridge that divide. Do you think that it's going to be the generation in between that helps to facilitate that communication? Or does one generation or another have to kind of get over itself? I've always kind of felt like the boomers need to kind of get over this fear of the millennial coming in, because that's who's inheriting the company. And the millennials need to step up a bit and really take some guidance and instruction and mentorship from baby boomers. What do you see as being this kind of secret sauce to making this all work?
Well, here's the interesting dynamic, and I will tell you that there are a lot of people who are greater experts in depth on millennials than I am, but I've been doing a lot of research on it because more and more of the customers and more of the vendors out there are employing millennials just by the sheer numbers. So it's something you have to take seriously and have to really embrace and understand.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly what happens is, and every generation before has had the same issue. And what happens is the prior generation says, well, how come these new guys want to do it differently? How come they aren't just content doing it the way we've always done it? And the reality is because their experience tells them that there's a better way. And if they're committed to doing things a better way, then they don't want to waste their time doing things the stupid old way someone else did it. Now, I say that sarcastically, but that's really what's going on, is people are saying, well, that other way was stupid. I'm not going to do it that way. There are a few other things that play into it, which is most millennials have gone through some scenario where they had a parent who lost their job.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason they lost their job was because the company that allegedly was going to take care of them, was going to look after them for years and years, changed their mind and said, yeah, you know what? We're not going to take care of you anymore. So now you're kind of on your own. So what happens is the millennials say, look, I don't necessarily buy into this idea. So you got to paint a picture for me on what my career path is. And if you don't do that, I don't trust that you're going to just work in my best interest. So I'm not on board. And when you combine that with, you know, oftentimes what will happen is in the, and this is through a number of different people that I reference in the article. What I've learned is that a manager will say, look, just do it this way. And millennials are all about figuring out the best way to do it. So instead, if you said, look, here's the result we're looking for. Here's the way we've done it in the past, which you're welcome to do it that way. If you think there's a better way to do it, let me know. Then they're probably going to go, yeah, you know what? That makes some sense. Here's where I might change some things. But if you literally say to them, hey, do step one, do step two, do step three, the Gen Y person says, well, okay, until I understand the end goal, I'm not doing it because I've seen too many people waste time doing things that don't make sense. And so there's a major generational difference there. And it's just, you know, if you think about it, I mean, my kids are way more advanced. I've got a son who's 14, and he's studying stuff in chemistry that I didn't study until I was like a freshman in college. But, you know, it's just the way things work. So I don't sit there and say, oh, why are they teaching him this? I'm like, wow, that's cool that he's learning this way earlier than I did.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you this. Let me kind of not exactly push back on it, but what happens when you do have the best way? I mean, what happens when you have gone through the different permutations and the idea that's being presented to you by the millennial is not the way that it should work? Is that just a communication problem, or is it that you kind of have to let them fail so that they can see that there's a better way? You know, what do you do in that scenario when, you know, you're very accomplished, you've done a lot of things in your career? What happens when, you know, a 22-year-old comes in and tells you you're doing it wrong and brings up something that you've either tried before or you know for certain is just not going to work?
Well, here's the big difference, that it used to be that businesses were run very much from a dictatorial standpoint. Do this, I'm the boss, you just do it. And now we've got more of a culture of buy-in. And to that end, the difference is when someone says to me, like, for example, I'll be working with an organization on sales strategy, and some millennials say, well, I don't think that works. I think we should do it this way. And instead of saying, no, that doesn't work, I go, okay, let's walk through that. So if we do that, so you want to call, you want to address it this way, right? Yeah, let's role play it. And then so they'll share that with me, and then I'll give a response that they're probably not anticipating. And they give this blank stare, and I say, okay, see, that was my concern, is that might happen. Let's try it the other way, and then you tell me, we'll go with whichever one you think is better.
Yeah.
And it's almost that self-discovery, and it's the difference of the millennials, and I hate to generalize, because not every millennial thinks this way,
mm-hmm.
and it's a broad category of people, so, but in general, and, you know, it's, you know, we're assuming, we all know what happens, we assume. But in general, millennials want to be part of discovering the solution. They don't want someone to just tell them how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so to that end, if you – and by the way, this isn't just work with millennials. It works with everybody. It's just in prior generations, people would tolerate it the other way.
Yep. Got it. Got it. Yeah, no, that all totally makes sense. And I really like the idea of using sort of practice and self-discovery in a safe environment as a way of making that the learning experience instead of kind of dropping them into the deep end, so to speak.
In my prior technology company, so I had grown a couple of companies from 93 to 98. We were like a Fast 50 company, one of the 50 fastest growing companies in the Washington, D.C. area. We then built a software company. We sold both of them in 2005. To a group of investment bankers, and then we grew the parent company to a value from $100 million to a couple billion dollars, where I served as managing director. The big thing that we did back then, that we were just lucky, it wasn't like I had this great vision, I just got lucky, but we never told people how to write code. We never told people how to develop something or how to solve it. We would say, look, here is very well defined the problem that the client is trying to solve. Here is very well defined the results that the client is expecting. So we need to make sure that we solve this problem and deliver at a minimum these results. Now, you guys come up with the best way to solve it. And what happened was in the midst of one of the most competitive time frames for technology company employees, we had almost zero turnover because everyone was engaged. They got to use their creativity and figure out how to solve problems. Now that something like they teach, we just got lucky and, you know, kind of stumbled across it.
Yeah, it's like the early days of a hackathon, really.
Yeah, we just didn't know it.
Yeah. All right, well, that's kind of cool. So, I mean, you've had this really interesting career where you've gotten to do stuff like that, and then you arrive here. And, I mean, I think it's obvious from anybody listening and anybody that's ever had the chance to talk to you that you really love what you do. And I think that that's no coincidence that you've arrived here. I think you've made a lot of decisions in the way you've gone about coming to this point in your career. What has been some of the things that you can point to as decision points or just inflection points in your business where it could have gone one way or the other, and you arrived at this place where you get to have this career that's built around work that you really enjoy doing? Because I think a lot of people, and I know for certain that a lot of people that listen to this podcast in particular, you know, I get feedback from people that listen, they're people that work in a job, and maybe they're not thrilled about it, but they may have an idea, it's burning in them, or it could just be anybody that has this creative juice that they want to just let out and do something with. How did you identify when it was time to make this leap and do the thing that you're doing now?
So Jeff, I'm going to give you two different stories. One was when I started my first company, and then what led me to start this company. Does that work?
Yeah, that works perfectly.
Okay, cool. So in my first company, I was, you know, a few years out of college, I was working for this mainframe-based company, and I had identified all this potential business. I was running, this is a mainframe-based company I was running at the time, was called the client-server division, which basically meant I was helping people start using PCs instead of using mainframes. Mm-hmm. But it sounded more elegant if we called it client-server. And there were a number of clients who really didn't want to have anything to do with the mainframe. They just wanted to start migrating stuff to PC-based systems. And so there were a number of opportunities there to help people do that. And the company said, no, we don't want to do that, because then these people might shift off the mainframe sooner. So it was kind of that scarcity mindset. And I remember talking to this guy, Bob, who I worked for. And I said to Bob, I said, you know, it's so frustrating because there's a ton of business that we could be getting. I'm not permitted to go after it. Bob says, well, why don't you write it down? So I'm writing it down on a whiteboard. And I said, well, here's this account, and it's, you know, $250,000 easily this year. And here's this other account, and it's $250,000. And here's this other one, it's 150. And so Bob looks at me and he goes, well, what do you need to be able to actually execute on these projects? And I said, well, nothing. I just need permission. Bob would close the door and he goes, so why don't you do it? And I said, well, no, I don't have permission. He said, I don't mean here. I mean, why don't you do it? Because right now, you don't have a family. You don't have a mortgage payment. You don't even have a dog. Like, this is not necessarily a bad time to do this. And it's not like you're still in business from the company. The company doesn't want this business anyhow. They're going to find somebody. It may as well be you. And that's how I started my first company, was I just went out. And it's funny. I had this whole plan. I was going to call in all these clients. And I literally resigned from the company. And 3 days later, one of the clients said, hey, we just called up and they said you're not there anymore. And I remember I had your home number. So can you come help us? And it wasn't even one of the companies on the list. And I ended up working with at the time it was SmithKline Beecham, now it's GlaxoSmithKline and Chubb Insurance and all these Fortune 500 companies that really in hindsight were crazy to contract out to a sole practitioner for these enterprise applications, but it worked out fine. So then we grew those companies. So by the way, the funny thing is, like, employee number four or five was this guy Bob, who I hired as a COO to manage me. So that side became kind of funny. And then if you want, I can tell you the story of how that evolved into what I do now.
Yeah, so tell me that, but I want to pause for a minute because I think what's really interesting about that story, and this is, I think, the point that people hit in their lives, and it's that it was that moment where you were standing there saying, but I need permission. And I think that that is a very common part of every entrepreneur's story, I think, where there's this moment where you decide you don't want to ask for permission anymore, or that this is a smart enough, calculated enough risk that it's worth going out and just doing it without permission.
You know what? That's a great point, Jeff. I mean, it really just comes down to that notion of, you know, that what you've got is the right thing to do, and you can have all the self-talk in the world that tells you why you can't do it. And it's funny because this guy Bob, who ended up being my COO and ended up being the COO of the parent company with me after you know, all the acquisitions and everything, Bob was like, look, you know, if you want, I can help you come up with a list of 100 reasons why you shouldn't do it, but you've got a vision for this and it's driving you nuts that you can't do it. So you can either spend your life regretting that you didn't do it, or you can pull the trigger. He said, and I'm not telling you which to do. I'm just telling you that's the fork in the road you're at right now.
God, and please tell me you're still friends with Bob.
Oh, you know what? Bob and I are great friends still. Yeah. You know what? He and I were business partners for the better part of 20 years and still stay in touch. I mean, he does something totally different now, but it was a interesting thing.
All right. So tell me the second piece about how that jump and being able to take on these big projects and everything led you to this next position where you are.
Sure. So after we sold the company, cash and stock deal, growing the company worldwide, I was flying about 175,000 miles a year and wasn't spending as much time as I wanted to with my wife and with my children. And I thought, man, why am I still doing this? And I asked myself that question multiple times over a period of weeks, and I never had a good answer. And even though I was a highly compensated executive of a company with values in excess of $1 billion, I literally just went to the board and said, I'm done. And they looked at me like, what do you mean you're done? Now, this is a company that had been flat for 4 years prior to our acquisition. Post-acquisition, the combined values of the company was $100 million. And as I was leading it, we, in 3 years, you know, grew the value of the company about 20-fold. So they were not exactly thrilled that I said, yeah, I'm done, and I don't know what I'm going to do yet. And I figured, okay, I'll start another technology-related company. And I was talking to some friends, and literally I would just like call a bunch of buddies and say, hey, I'm buying dinner, whoever wants to come out. And there'd be like a dozen of us sitting at a Tex-Mex place. And I said, yeah, maybe I'll start a technology company. And one of my friends says, you know, you say that, but it's almost like you're apologizing, like you're not into it. And I said, yeah, I don't know what I want to do. And they said, you know, and a bunch of them chimed in. They said, every time over the last several years that any of our businesses were struggling, you would drop everything you're doing and come help us. And it's like that was more fun than anything you were doing. And I realized that I actually had more fun helping businesses grow than I enjoyed running them, because I really hated running them. But I loved the idea of rapid growth and being creative and coming up with new ways. And so one of them said, why don't you do that? And I'm like, you can do that? Like, because if you think about it, we had successful businesses. We had never brought in someone from the outside to help us grow or to focus on our sales. I just took that stuff for granted. And that's when I started this business. And you're right. I mean, I wake up every day and I get to do exactly what I thoroughly enjoy doing. And I often think it's funny when, I mean, as you know, as somebody who speaks, I mean, I always laugh that, okay, I get paid a lot of money to come talk about stuff that I love talking about, that I know has a dramatic impact on the people in the room. And, you know, don't let the word get out, but I'd probably do it for free.
Yep. I say that all the time when it comes to like public speaking. You know, I love my clients. I love the strategy work we do and everything. But my two favorite things that I do are public speaking about the topics that I know about, because I just get jazzed about seeing people light up and have an aha moment. And then I do this other thing called consulting over coffee, where I sit down with somebody for 60 to 75 minutes. It's only $250 to sit down, but it's my favorite thing that I do because I get to like pay complete attention to someone and really work through a problem that's not as rigidly defined as the services that we do. I get to kind of go off into other creative places, so I can completely appreciate that.
Cool.
Yeah. So
yeah, that's great stuff. I'm going to ask you more about that at some point.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure we'll have a chance to do that. I want to dig a little bit into exactly what it is that you do, because you're mostly advising companies how to grow, and your main area where you spend that time is in sales, right? That tends to be the majority of, I'm sure there's other areas you touch on, but sales is a big piece of it, right?
Yeah. It's the sales, it's the messaging side of it. So what I always say is, you can have the best sales force in the world, and if your message sucks, then guess what? You got a pretty tough time getting people to want to meet with you if you can't capture their attention with your message. So the sales and marketing are forever intertwined.
Mm-hmm. And obviously, we're assuming that the product and service is already good, because you don't want to sell crap dressed up and exactly. wrapped in pretty wrapping paper. Exactly. But you have this, I don't know what to call it, whether it's a phrase or a moniker or just a way of encapsulating your brand of doing this, which you use integrity-based sales. I see that in a lot of the copy that you write and a lot of the ways that you speak about things. Can you talk a little bit more about what you mean when you say integrity-based sales? Because I think integrity means something different to a lot of different people. There's the textbook definition, but I'd love to hear how you define integrity-based sales.
Yeah, and the reason it's funny. One of the early comments I get from people is, wow, integrity and sales, those are two words you usually don't hear next to each other.
Yeah, well, I mean, as part of this, I'd love also, I think sales is one of those words that makes people feel a little queasy, especially if it's something that they're accountable for. They're just, I don't like selling. I hear that more often than I'd like to admit. And back when I worked for other companies, I hated sales as well. And then as soon as I started my company, I basically fell completely in love with sales. So as you're talking about this integrity-based sales, I mean, if you can touch on that feeling that people get and how this might be somewhat of a remedy for that, I would love to hear it, because I'm constantly fighting that battle that sales is not icky.
Yeah, well, and by the way, you touched on something that's very, very real, which is people who are not in sales want nothing to do with it. And so one of the things often when I work with like CEO groups, like I'll speak to these groups like Vistage or EO or YPO, and I'll ask them, I'll say, okay, you're on the receiving end of a visit from a salesperson. And right before they come in, someone says, oh, by the way, this salesperson's here to meet with you, and they've slipped through the gauntlet and they broke through security and now they're coming to meet with you. What adjectives do you think of when you think salesperson? And rarely does someone say something positive. They usually say slimy, pushy, you know, smooth talker. And for the same reason, when you walk into a store, and I'm sure you've walked into a store, and you walk into a place and the hyper-ambitious salesperson comes up to you and says, hey, Jeff, may I help you? And what do you most often say when someone says,
I'm just looking.
Yeah, no thanks, just looking. And why is that?
Is that a rhetorical question, or is that?
Think about it, and then tell me what you think. Why do you say that? Why do you say no thanks, just looking?
Because I wasn't seeking them out. I would say is like the biggest thing. If I need help, I want to come and ask for it. I don't want it to be proactively pushed in my face, and I think that's where pushy comes in for me.
Exactly, and my guess is the very first sales clerk, when they walked up to someone and said, "May I help you?" The other person didn't say, no thanks, just looking. The other person said, wow, that's great. I'd love it if you could help me. And then over time, they discovered that the person doesn't really mean that. What they really mean is, how can I help me sell you something? Mm-hmm. And that pushiness in sales just doesn't work. Almost every book that's ever been written about sales prior to what we wrote in Same Side Selling uses either a game metaphor or a war metaphor. So in a game, you typically have a winner or a loser. Mm-hmm. And so you have a winner and a loser in every game. In a battle metaphor, you have a winner and the loser dies. And yeah. then people wonder why there's this adversarial tension between buyers and sellers. So when I talk about integrity-based selling, what it means is your job as the seller, first and foremost, is to determine, is there a good fit between what this client is trying to solve and our expertise? And if there isn't, it's my job to tell them that. And now, if there is a good fit, then it's my job to make sure that the value of my solution exceeds the impact of their organization of not solving that problem. And if it isn't, I should advise my client that, look, I think you're going to spend more than this problem's costing you. And it may sound counterintuitive, and people say, how can you do that? But when you do that, all of a sudden, your client doesn't see you as someone there to sell, but instead, you're there to help solve something important and basically discover, is there a problem worth solving?
Mm-hmm. Got it.
So yeah. Hopefully that answers your question.
It really does, because I love it, because some of the ways that I talk about sales with people who are shy around the idea of sales and things like that, it hits on some of those points. I often like to say that don't think of it as sales. Think of it as trying to solve someone else's problem. And if you can solve it, then great. If you can't, then you would tell them that. But if you can sell them it, I generally say this, and this is how I feel about what we do. The reason I fell in love with what we do is that I feel that we are the best in our market doing what we do. And if somebody comes to me, I don't feel bad selling to them, because if I don't work with them and do the best job I can, I know that they're going to go with somebody else. They're looking for a solution to a problem. If I don't step up and show them that I'm the best for it, they're going to go with somebody else who's not going to do as good of a job. So it's my responsibility to help them. That's how I think of myself as a salesperson, is that it's my job to do the best work for them.
Yeah. You know what? And that's exactly it. And here's the thing. The client who's not the right fit for you ends up being a toxic client you wish you had never gotten to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a difficult thing. There's a model that we talk about in the book of the right type of pitch that we call a same side pitch. And it follows this principle of what we call entice, disarm, and discover. So the entice part is that you describe the problems that you solve with amazing results. You then disarm the notion you're just there to sell something by acknowledging that not everyone's a good fit for you. And then you trigger a discovery phase to learn more about them. So if you think about it, like, you know, you guys provide social media strategy, consulting, training. There's a whole bunch of things. But what's the underlying problem that one of your clients would be facing that tells you that they might need that help?
Usually they're coming to us and saying something like, we need to generate more leads. Nobody knows who we are. We need to build brand awareness, or, you know, we're simply not closing the sales. Something is messed up in our funnel.
Yeah. So if you think about it, you could either say, hey, we provide social media strategy, consulting, training for these types of companies. And man, we're all over this stuff. And they might feel like, wow, they're being sold to. If instead, if you said, you know, medium-sized companies typically come to me because they're facing one of two or three things. Either their competitor, who's really inferior to them, is getting all sorts of attention and visibility and getting more press than they are, and they can't believe that these guys are getting all this press and they're not. The second thing is that no one knows about them, so even though they got great stuff, they just don't have enough leads to generate business for them. Or the other thing is that there's all these new channels out there, and they just know that internally they're really good at what they do, but they don't know the right way in which social media they should be on and shouldn't be, and where to not waste money. Now, for the right businesses, they tell us, this is the disarm part, right? So now I'm still in the entice, and I say for the right types of businesses, they tell us that we deliver amazing results and shift that around, and within months, all of a sudden they got new deals coming in. They've got new leads all over the place, and they're getting more visibility. And now here's the disarm part. But not every business we talk to is the right fit for how we approach that. So I don't yet know whether or not we can help you. But if solving that is important to you, then I'm happy to learn more to see if we can help.
Yep. I absolutely love that. That is and it fits with some of the other strategies and different you know, literature and things that I've read about sales. And, you know, I'm constantly trying to educate myself. One of the ones that I reference a lot is Oren Claff with Pitch Anything and his whole kind of neurofinance way of pitching. And I'm about to read Michael Port's Steal the Show. That's on my list next. And I have your book in the queue as well.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, it's this whole idea of entice, disarm, discover. And by the way, the most common question I get is, well, shouldn't you start with discover first? So one of my recent Forbes articles had the three worst questions that salespeople ask.
Ooh, can you tell us what they are?
Yeah, and one of the first ones is, so what keeps you up at night? So they used to tell people in consultative selling, well, you go and you ask them what keeps you up at night. So someone says, hey, what keeps you up at night? They could respond to you and say, well, my dog licks himself. I mean, now what are you going to do? Like, you got a solution for that? So if you start with entice, disarm, and discover, then you're enticing by saying these are the types of problems we're good at solving. Now, if you really do some soul searching, if you're talking to a client who isn't facing one of the top three problems that you're good at solving, they're probably not a good fit for you.
Mm-hmm.
And so your job becomes to narrowly define the problems you're good at solving. And once you do, you show up in a totally different way. There's a client of mine that's in the IT outsourcing business. And they came to me because they said, yeah, I mean, we got a message. It just falls on deaf ears. We go to like networking events and like we couldn't pay someone to take our business card. And literally we did a full day session with their team to work on sales strategy and to come up with this same side pitch for them. Which, by the way, there's usually defined six or seven different problems you're good at solving. You pick the two or three that best fit that particular situation. And so about a month after this, I said, well, how's it going? He goes, well, the biggest thing we learned is that we got to bring like way more business cards when we go to events now, because we use that and like we keep running out of business cards. And I'm kind of shaking my head like, okay, like you didn't think to bring more cards the second or third time.
That's fantastic.
But it just changes that dynamic a little bit.
So let me ask you this, though. You have these frameworks, and I absolutely love that you have these frameworks because it really is easier to wrap your head around it when you have, you know, something that you can really define and grapple. And your background is from all, you know, all walks of a career. And then your if I read your profile right, you have a background in quantitative economics and decision science. So you've come up with these frameworks. How much of it is a result of looking at different studies and kind of coming up with theories and testing them versus kind of real world stumbling upon these results and different things?
Well, there's two ways I'll answer that. The first is, I don't think any of us has ever come up with an original idea. What I mean by that is everything's a derivative work and everything has been influenced by something else. So, you know, I've studied a lot of different selling systems. And so I guarantee that, you know, consciously or unconsciously, I'm influenced by some systems more than others. Mm-hmm. Because candidly, I would look at different systems and say, wow, this works really well, but that one doesn't. So I don't really like that one, but oh, this one I really like. And hey, this one system has these three things well, but then these two things fall apart. So
you basically remixed it.
Yeah. So I've remixed it, but I've also, what I've done is said, okay, what are the things that generated explosive growth for my businesses as I was growing up? And what are the things that at the time we thought were working that in hindsight maybe weren't? And what are the things that really make a difference? And that's what I bring to the table now is, so when I'm working with businesses, you know, I want people to discover on their own, but there are certain paths that I know, look, you can try that path if you want, but it's not going to work. Like there's certain concepts. And I always say, look, you have to speak in your voice, not my voice. So don't look for a script from me, because if you're reading a script, you're going to sound like it. Having said that, there are two or three things that I say, now look, this one particular phrase, don't mess with it. So you need to rehearse it enough so it becomes your voice. Mm-hmm. Because I will tell you that you can try it 75 different ways. And this way, across all my clients, across everybody I talk to, this way works dead on 100%. And variations of that, not so much. So, you know, it's, you know, I'm always open to new ideas. And let's face it, it's not like a silver bullet. There's no light switch that says, oh, you flip this switch, and now you're going to grow. There's hard work involved, but it's a lot of it comes down to strategy.
Awesome. Well, Ian, you are just awesome to talk to, and I know that we have a hard stop coming up, and I could definitely sit here and just chat with you for hours upon hours, but I know we had to call it quits at some point, but I would absolutely love to have you back anytime. But before I let you go, please tell everyone listening where they can go to be social with you, learn more about you, and I'll take everything you tell me and I'll put it in the show notes so that they can follow you around the web.
Absolutely. You know, the easiest way is through Grow My Revenue. So the website is growmyrevenue.com. My Twitter handle is Grow My Revenue. You know, over the next year or so, we're probably going to switch that over to Ian Altman, just because I own those as well. And more often than not, it requires more words, because someone will tweet about something and say, Ian Altman, parentheses, at Grow My Revenue. Mm-hmm. And I'm just, at some point, it's like, okay, I'm making people work too hard. But so either one will get to me, but Grow My Revenue is probably the easiest place to find me.
Okay, awesome. I'll put that all in the show notes. Ian, thanks so much for being on the show. For all of you out there listening, thanks for tuning in. I work my butt off to try and get amazing people like Ian on the show. And Ian, thanks again for being on. So everyone out there, thanks for listening. Have a great night, day, whatever time you're listening.
It was fun, Jeff. Thanks.
Thanks for listening. This has been Conversations, the True Voice Media podcast. And if this is your first time listening, please do us a favor and drop by iTunes or Stitcher and give us a rating. Tell us what you love about the show and what we can do to improve the show. If you're not yet a subscriber, you can subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher, or you can be notified by email about new episodes. To subscribe, just drop by truevoicemedia.com/conversations. Tune in next time, where I bring on another incredible guest and have another interesting conversation. See you next time.